Well, I'm happy to introduce my good friend Steve Mortley to you this morning. Some of you who wondered who this man was who's been attending here at church during the time that I have, we learned to know each other in the mid-90s when we both came to the area to pastor churches and then met at the ministerial. Steve has had a number of challenges in his life, and I thought it would be good for you to hear his perspective and his story this morning as a pastor. So, Steve, God bless you as you share.
Thank you. How about that, Waldo? One of the good guys, right? I hope you know by now you're lucky to have had him as your pastor, right? You know that. Okay. Yeah. Okay, that hand clap was good. That gives me evidence there's a bunch of people here. And so I can go right ahead and do my thing. I do need audible eye contact now and again. So let's just try that. I'm going to say good morning, everybody. And you'll say, hey, Steve, how are you doing? So try that. Good morning, everybody.
Hey, Steve, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing fine. Thanks for asking. So we're connected now. So let's proceed. It was a few years ago, I was walking from my house overlooking Diamond Sea over at the ballpark there in Virgil towards the walking path, and there were a couple of Niagara-on-the-Lake town employees working on Diamond B, and I overheard one of the dudes say to his buddy, there's that blind guy, he's always walking. So two things about that. I'm not always walking. And number two, I can hear just fine. I can hear what people say. My hearing's just fine. So I thought I would answer the two questions that are implicit in that in those two statements. There's that blind guy. First of all, what's the deal with his eyesight? Secondly, why is he always walking? So I'm going to take those two in turn. So there's that blind guy. So I have a disease of the retina called retinitis pigmentosa. It's a fairly common eye disease as far as eye diseases go. It affects about 1 in 400,000 people. And it's a disease where, it's a congenital disease whereby the retina, particularly the cones in the retina, certain rods in the retina, they deteriorate over time. And they're responsible for peripheral vision and night vision. Both of those things slowly degenerate over time to the point where it all fades out eventually and eventually goes blind black. Now, most people want to know exactly what I see when I'm standing here. That's normal. It's common to wonder exactly what you see. When I first met Irv Wilms, he, being the good engineer that he is, conducted an impromptu field test on me. And he went over to a Canadian flag and says, what's this? And of course, I couldn't see it. And he said, well, that's all I need to know. Does that sound like Irv to you? So standing here in a building indoors, I can see the light. So I have light receptivity. I can see the windows and I can see those lights. That's about it. I can't see my hand, really. Now, outdoors, I would be able to see more. I can see movement a bit, like white cars, that kind of thing. It's a little bit better outdoors. So at this stage in my life, I consider myself lucky to have light reception. Lots of people with my disease have lost vision completely and, in fact, has blacked over. So light sensitivity is a wonderful thing. And a little bit of vision is better than none at all. But eventually, it will go black. So when I was a child, I knew just intuitively there was something wrong with my eyesight, and I had a hard time convincing the adults in my life of that. And so as children do, they adapt, and they just keep moving on. And when I was 16, I took my driver's license test, and I cheated flagrantly on that thing by looking into that little viewfinder, you know. And you're supposed to look straight ahead, and my eyes were darting back and forth to see the lights that were flashing. Anyway, I got my driver's license and proceeded on. Went through all the various levels of education, got married, had a family, went into pastoral ministry. When I was 32, I had an appointment with my ophthalmologist that I hadn't seen for a while. And I sat in his chair, and the first question he asked me is, "Do you still drive?" And I looked at him, and I nodded my head, and he looked at me and shook his head, and that was the end of that. So I wasn't about to argue with him. I knew by that time it was way past due that I shouldn't have been driving. So again, move on through life. 32 years old. Yeah, about 10 years ago, maybe 8 years ago, I started to lose eye contact and facial recognition. To me, that was the biggest change that I experienced. Like, people with vision have no idea how much communication goes on with your eyes and with your face. And when you lose that, it's a huge change. And so it's a big adaptation. Now, a lot of people have come up to me and said, and I don't mean to embarrass you if you said this to me, but they'll say, "Oh, you'll recognize my voice by now." Well, that's not exactly the way it works. Like, close your eyes after the service and wander around with people you've known your whole life and see if you recognize their voice. I recognize one person's voice here. It's Peter. He's got a very distinctive voice. But other than that, it's very difficult. We do use facial context to recognize each other. So John Epp came up to me before the service. He did everything right. He clapped his hand on my shoulder. He said, "It's John, Boater John. Now, please don't come up to me and say, 'My name is John.' Half of you are named John in this church for some reason." So, Boater John, hey, that gives me context because he has a boat this summer. He took me on his boat up the Niagara River into Lake Ontario. So I had that experience with John Epp. So I know that he's Boater John. So you say both of your names. If your name is John Thiessen, that's not specific enough. You need to give me context. And so that's sort of how it works with me. Say both names. Don't be afraid to touch me. I like physical touch. I know in North America we have this sort of 6 or 8 inch zone of exclusion around us. It's just the way we are. And so if you're around me, there's going to be some incidental contact. But the way of you making eye contact with me is to touch me on my arm or shoulder or something like that. I know it's difficult to adapt to. When Waldo and I are in Tim Hortons, sometimes I get a little bit too close to the person in front of me. I don't know if Waldo knows this, but he clears his throat as a way of expressing that I'm too close to him. And so I back off. It's just the way it is. It is kind of funny. I don't mean to sound cavalier about this, but people deal with loss of vision, loss of all kinds of things in their life, and we adapt to it. To be very honest, it's not the defining quality of my life. It may be to people looking at me, but it's not to me. It's just something that I've had to adapt to over the years, and it doesn't define me. We have all kinds of adaptability devices. I have all the gadgets that I need. So it's, again, it's a minor part of my life, as weird as that might sound. So on to the next part of that statement. Why is the blind guy always walking? September 3rd, early afternoon, Thursday, September 3rd, 1981. I was 18 years old, and I was sitting in the back seat of my parents' car in the parking lot of what is now Home Hardware in Elora, Ontario, right across from Tim Hortons there, a place that has become now family lore in our family. I was sitting in the back seat of the car waiting for my parents to come out of the store. They were looking at appliances. I had no interest in that. And just that, at that moment, I got a headache, much like you get a headache with the flu or with a cold. I still have the headache. That's 37 years later. It has never gone away, and it will never go away. I'll have it till the day I die. It's a condition that's called new daily persistent headache. It's been recognized in the literature in the last 10 years or so. It has its Wikipedia article if you want to look it up later. New daily persistent headache. And the only change that has happened over the years is the variability, the level of intensity. So I was just about to go into grade 13 at the time. And again, as humans, we're very adaptable. We put our heads down, we push on. And I progressed again through life, through various levels of education and career and family and so on. But a pattern began to develop whereby certain times there would be what I'd call a spike in the level of pain. And it would just sort of spiral out of control, and I just couldn't take it anymore. I'd have to go to a hospital and get a shot of Demerol. And then after 2 or 3 weeks, maybe even longer, I'd be able to go back to work to what I considered to be a level of functionality. So this happened for many years, and this event happened again when my youngest daughter, who's now 20, was born, 1998. So again, I thought this was predictable. I'll just go get another shot of Demerol and wait a little while and go back to normal. But it didn't go back to what I considered to be a functional level. It stayed at a very, very intense level. And that's sort of the level of intensity that I've been dealing with since that time. So again, unbeknownst to me, in 1998, there was a whole trend in the medical community whereby doctors were using opioid prescription pills to treat what we call non-cancerous pain. And I walked right into the teeth of that trend. Now, knowing what we know now, of course, we would never have done that. But at the time, I thought that the choice I had in front of me was a stark one, because I would be at the church, and I'd come home in the afternoon, and there'd be a couple hours of turnaround time before I have to go back for another meeting at the church. My boys were out in the backyard playing hockey with their little plastic hockey sticks. What was I going to do? I was in pain. I wanted to lay down. I was tired. Was I going to lay down? Or was I going to take one of those pills and go out and play with my boys? I chose to take one of those pills, and I went and played with my boys. The only problem, of course, is that you have to take it again, right? 4 hours down the road, and you keep have to take it, keep taking it. And pain docs call that physical dependency. Now, they make a distinction between physical dependency and addiction. They say that addiction are people that are taking it more than prescribed, they're taking handfuls of the stuff, they're overdosing, that kind of stuff. But the result is the same. Can't get off this stuff. And I knew pretty early on in this experience that the things that I was putting in my mouth to try to help me were the things that were going to kill me eventually if something didn't happen. And so that developed a long process of trying to get off these things. And I haven't really developed the ability or the words to describe that period. That's just a long 20-year period of darkness. And you and I have just met, and I'm really not going to get into it. I'm not that comfortable with it. Suffice it to say, about 2 years ago, at this time actually, January, I took my last pain pill. After years of trying to get off this stuff, slowly, they call it titrating down, all the things that you've heard about withdrawal, all that stuff, that all happened. I'm not going to describe it, but I finished. And for a year after that, my body didn't respond. I didn't think there was any reward for doing this because I didn't feel any better. But about a year ago, again at this time, January, Pam Pauls was in the going out of business sale for Sears in St. Catharines, and she saw this treadmill and brought it home. Waldo set it up in my basement, and I started going down in the morning because I had a little bit of energy, knees knocking, going on this treadmill, just walking really slow, like really gently. And over time, built that up a little faster, a little more, a little longer. Turned spring, got warm, and I thought, why am I walking on this treadmill? I can just go out and walk outside. So I did that. Started getting stronger, walking more, more and more. And then it got colder, and I don't like walking in the cold. And I thought, well, I'll walk if it gets if it stays above 15 degrees Celsius. So I did that. And I thought, well, maybe 10. And I thought, well, freezing, that's the cutoff right there. And sure enough, I've been walking in, minus 8 temperatures. They're picking ice wine grapes, and it's no problem at all. Meanwhile, I have a friend of mine who brought his tandem bicycle around, John. He might be here this morning. John came with his beautiful machine and sort of dragged me out onto his bike. I was not happy about it. I complained about it. Because I was in bed, I'd get up and go biking with him. To be clear, I was on the back, he was on the front. We did that for a couple of seasons, but it was only this past year that I started to feel the strength and the energy to the point where I love going out. And I'm saying, hey, John, when are we going out? It's a highlight of my week when we go out biking. Got connected with a physical personal trainer who's been helping me with strength training and yoga and that kind of thing. And slowly over time, developing strength in my body. My children have heard me say in the past that I want to be cremated when I die as a final act of revenge against a body that I feel has betrayed me in my lifetime. I want to report to you today that I no longer feel that way. It's different. And I'm thinking probably I'm not the only person that has or that did have that sense of dysmorphia, negative body image. We do have this complicated relationship with the body that we have. It's the only body we have. And yet in this comparison culture, we see around and we begin to despise the body that we inhabit. And as Christians, it can even be more complicated because we have this highly developed view of what should go on below the belt, not so much about what goes on around the belt, right? That's why I had Eric read that text this morning. The Apostle Paul is talking in that context. We're all familiar with, you know, your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit, and so we're supposed to honor God with our body. That's written in the context of human sexuality. So we have this very, very highly developed view of that. But when was the last time you heard someone read that passage, the next passage, just a few paragraphs down, again by the Apostle Paul, who says, I beat my body and make it my slave? To our ears, that sounds kind of weird, right? But in the context, of course, the Apostle Paul is talking about physical training. He references the Olympic Games that would have been familiar to his readers and says, I subject my body to physical training so that I can be more effective in my ministry. There was a goal to it. And so, you know, I believe in that. I believe that we're facing a time like no other. It's a unique time where people who are about my age and a little older are facing unprecedented age span. We're living a longer time, not necessarily better. And I think very strongly that we need to fortify ourselves against that stage of life. I don't know about you, but it's embarrassing to me to always be asking my kids for help on my electronic devices or whatever. We have to adapt, and as we get older, as we age, we need to have the mental acuity and physical strength to deal with those kinds of things. And we need to prepare ourselves and fortify ourselves. It's getting really quiet in here. Is anyone with me? Let's have some audible eye contact. All right. Okay, fair enough. For those of you who are younger than me, the issue is, again, the comparison culture. You are being constantly bombarded by images as to how you are supposed to appear, what you're supposed to say, particularly how you're supposed to look. I just got an iPhone recently. And that thing has started hissing and buzzing and spitting at me, and I'm thinking, like, I have to worry about what all the other people are thinking now. I was having a hard time with my own thoughts. And that's what kids are subjected to. And my point is, we need physical exercise in our body to make sure that we can cope with the added mental strain of social media and all the things that we have to deal with. And I think that physical exercise is a God-given way of handling those kinds of things. I simply want to end by asking, what is the nature of disability? Do we need to think differently about disability? Like, has anyone ever seen the Paralympics? Ever watch those on TV? Like, by what measure can we say that these people are disabled? Not disabled at all. Look what they're doing. It's astounding. They're not disabled. I think we need to think about disability in terms of inertia, passivity. Like, we live in this culture of Netflix and chill, right? And we get into this rut whereby we can't make our minds make our body do something that is uncomfortable to us, that is uncomfortable, such as exercise. And it's a real problem for some people. None of you, I know, none of you. You know, you're all hardworking Mennonites, very disciplined, and so maybe someone listening online or something, I don't know. But we do live in this culture, you know, the sitting culture. And churches, sorry to say, churches are the worst. We sit around in church. We sit around committee meetings. We sit at table eating things we shouldn't eat. And don't get me started about that. I'm not going to say anything about that. We sit. And churches need to be places that foster the spirit of activity. We need to encourage each other to be active, to do things, to be engaged. I used to teach spiritual formation to graduate students. And I'm still very much committed to the disciplines of the faith that help us develop and grow in our faith. But any program of spiritual discipline that does not include a strong physical dimension is hamstrung from the beginning. Like, we're asking God to help us for our problem, help us with our problems, and we've got homework to do. Like, do the first things first. This is spiritual wisdom that goes back hundreds of years in our tradition. The Wesleyans and the Puritans all knew it, that the first thing you do, you don't look for spiritual issues first. You look for physical explanations of what's going on first, and then spiritual. So we start with the physical component and develop that in our lives. And my charge to you this morning is, let's focus on that, first of all. So why is the blind guy always walking? Because he can, frankly. And for 20 years, he was mostly indoors, laying in bed. And got a new lease on life. And he's walking because he loves to walk. He can't imagine stopping walking. I just love the feeling of movement. And I would invite each one of you, all you non-disciplined Mennonites, to get involved, get started, do something, like something. it doesn't have to be a 5K walk. It doesn't have to be long. Like, if you can't walk 5K, walk 30 feet. Something. Start something, but do it every day. Like, people say, oh, I don't like exercising. I went out and ran, and oh, I felt awful after that. Of course you felt awful. See, overdid it. You start small, and you slowly increase incrementally, and you build up the strength. And over time, you begin to realize, oh, my, I'm able to do this. Like, I couldn't do this before, now I can. And we can encourage one another to do that. Be an active people. This is the way we're designed to live. And we have to intentionally live against the culture that is always telling us to sit and be static and passive. And we have to fight against the inertia. So my benediction to you this morning, friends, let's be active people. Let's get involved. Let's encourage one another. Let's get after it. Okay, are you with me? Yeah. Good.